When the First World War broke out in 1914, it unleashed unimaginable carnage and upheaval. By the time that war ended 4 years later, almost 40 million lives had been lost, dynasties had collapsed, and the global political order was shaken to its core. And yet, was the world fundamentally changed? That was the question on the mind of our next guest, author Charles Emerson. For his new book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War, Emerson takes us on a tour of the world as it was a century ago. Charles Emerson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
There's a quote that struck me in the book, an Austrian writer, Stefan Zweig, talking about the destruction that World War I caused. He says, "All the bridges between our today and our yesterday and our yesteryears have been burnt." You kind of feel that's not the case.
Well, he was, of course, writing in 1940, a long time after the end of the First World War. So Zweig, looking back, sees the time before the war, as I think we tend to see, as this halcyon golden age. And what I want to bring to our contemporary understanding of the year 1913 is the extent to which actually that time was modern, it was dynamic, it was very highly globalized.
Highly globalized, and perhaps the most important power at the time in 1913 was the British Empire.
Without a doubt.
But you find some evidence that there's starting to be some cracks in terms of looking towards Britain's future.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, London is still very much the center of the world. It's the center of global finance. Britons are by far the largest investors in the world, and the empire is, you know, it covers a huge extent of the Earth's surface. But there are more question marks and increasingly insistent question marks about whether this whole extraordinary empire, whether that can really all hold together when you have these other rising powers, Germany, the United States, and indeed, of course, in Asia. So there are question marks abroad, but there are also question marks at home. It's a year of union militancy. It's a year of suffragette militancy. This is a year where there's a bomb placed under the throne of the Bishop of London in St. Paul's Cathedral. And it's a year where actually the idea of a civil war over home rule for Ireland is considered a very real possibility.
So interesting, because I feel like when we think about a history and World War I, we think of the war as in many ways being responsible for, you know, Britain's fall. I mean, that you had this cream of a generation killed off in the trenches of France. But you were starting to see signs earlier than that.
Well, I think the tectonic plates are already shifting before the war. What the war does, of course, is accelerate a lot of changes. And I think there is a sense around the world that Europe, which is the unquestioned supreme civilization in 1913, by 1918, at the end of the war, that really is no longer the case.
Let's move, if we can, to the United States of America, as you said, in 1913, kind of emerging. And you describe Washington, the U.S. Capitol, this new reform-minded Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, gets elected. He's talking about a new vision. He's talking about change. He's doing this at a time when money is increasingly playing a role in politics. I mean, this all sounds kind of familiar.
It kind of does. I mean, it's sort of terrifying when you read it, actually. The struggle between Wall Street and Main Street, for example, comes through again and again and again in 1913 in the election of Woodrow Wilson, or in the first year of his presidency. And that does sound terribly familiar. And I think the really key thing and fascinating thing about Woodrow Wilson is that he wants his presidency very much to be about nation building, the man who's going to sort of stitch America back together. And of course, now, when we look at his presidency, we think, you know, he's mostly a foreign policy president. And I think that certainly has resonance today.
Talking about kind of these eerie comparisons, maybe between 1913 and 2013 in the United States, I mean, it brings to mind a quote that you've talked about from Mark Twain, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Yeah, I think it's a danger for any historian mulling on contemporary affairs to say, you know, what happened 100 years ago, well, exactly the same thing is going to happen now. But I think you can learn some things from history. One lesson which I would learn or try to take from 1913 is that even at a time where the world seems to be going in the direction of being more globalized, more integrated, something can go wrong. I think there's a tendency to imagine, well, you know, the internet, technology is pulling the world ever closer together. It's just totally impossible and inconceivable that this world could stop, that it could begin to fall apart, that it could disintegrate. And of course, that's what lots of people thought in 1913, they thought, okay, yes, people talk about war, and yes, it's not entirely impossible that there will be a war, although pretty much no one thought that it would be the kind of war which happened or that it would have the kind of consequences which it had. So people can be very wrong about what they expect the future to be. And I think that's an important lesson in humility, frankly.
The lesson being be careful with our assumptions.
Be very careful with our assumptions. And, you know, don't let history happen to you. Be part of history. Try and make the history that you want to live in.
You had a quote in an article that you wrote in Foreign Policy magazine. A world economy is interconnected as never before by flows of money, trade, people. A global society, perhaps even a global moral consciousness, is emerging as a result. Small town America rails at the excessive power of Wall Street. Asia's rising once again. And yes, there's trouble in the Middle East. It really does sound familiar to what we know today.
If you went out onto the streets of a big city in 1913, what would you see? You'd see planes, trains, and automobiles. You'd see advertising, you'd see electric lights, you'd see skyscrapers, you'd see cinemas. So this time, which we often think of as being black and white, you know, Downton Abbey presents it as being really all about class and garden parties and
right.
You know, people in uniform. And actually, what I wanted to do in sort of providing this tour of the world with not just the European cities and the American cities, but also cities in Asia, Shanghai, Tokyo, etc., is to give a real sense of people's horizons, which were at that time very global. Remember, this is an age of tremendous immigration. It's also an era of great financial globalization. You have the gold standard. So I really wanted to push that message of modernity, globalization, and fundamentally this idea that in 1913, for most people, the war was not inevitable.
Well, Charles Emerson, thanks for taking us on this tour.
Thank you.
We've been talking to historian Charles Emerson. His new book is 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
Happened more than 150 years ago, but the devastation it wrought still reverberates today. The Irish potato blight reduced fields to rotten mush, causing mass starvation and driving more than a million Irish to flee, seeking a better life. And as it turns out, that enormous famine was caused by one tiny pest, a pathogen. A team of researchers based here in the U.S. and in Europe was only recently able to identify it. Sofiane Camoun, senior scientist at the Sainsbury Lab in the UK, was a co-author of the study.
We went to museum specimens and took diseased potato leaves that have been stored all the time in these museums. And we extracted DNA, we extracted genetic material from these leaves. And we were able, using the latest technology, to sequence the genome of the potato blight.
Wow. So I understand that some of these old potato leaves were actually stored at the Royal Gardens at Kew in London.
Absolutely. We got samples from there. Some of them date back to Ireland from 1845, just the start of the epidemic. Yes, it was great to really access this material. It's hidden treasures, really, in these museums. Amazing.
And what did you call this pathogen? Describe it, would you?
Yeah, so what we found was really interesting. What we found is a new strain of the potato blight pathogen. We called it Herb 1. And what was interesting about Herb 1 is Herb 1 is different from all the modern strains we looked at. So what we think has happened is Herb 1 is gone. It's extinct. Herb 1 was quite dominant in the 19th century. It's the only strain we could detect over a period of 50 years. But what happened is in the 20th century, it was replaced by another strain known as US1. And US1 dominated most of the 20th century before being replaced itself by other strains.
What does that teach you, Sofiane Camoun, as a scientist, about the way that pathogens evolve?
It's a very interesting lesson. It teaches us that these pathogens are very dynamic. They're changing all the time. They're adapting to the breeding we do to try to bring in resistant potatoes. And I'm in awe at this pathogen and its ability to change and evolve and really keep up with us people and scientists.
The potato is still a very important food to feed the world hungry. Should we be concerned about new potato blights?
Potato is still a very important crop in the world. It's the third most important food crop. And potato blight is the most important disease of potato. And so it is a very important disease, and we still need to manage this pathogen.
So what is in the future using this same DNA sequencing?
There's hidden treasures in these museums and this herbaria. It's amazing that now we can go back and exploit this material that's stored in these museums and look not just at the shape of the leaves or the shape of the flowers or identify the species that are stored there, but also study the genetic makeup of all these samples that are there. I like to say that going back to the past is important for preparing to the future.
That's Sofian Khamoun, senior scientist at the Sainsbury Lab in Norwich in the United Kingdom. He's co-author of a study detecting the source of the Irish potato famine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jackie.